In my town, we need immigrants. This hour, one view on how immigrants are keeping the community of Storm Lake alive. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowan Art Cullen joins us to talk about his opinion piece this week in the New York Times. Before that, we'll learn about Susan Christensen, who's just been appointed to the Iowa Supreme Court. Also, a criminologist on why some missing persons cases receive more attention, why pesky robocalls are surging, and what you can do about it, and Elwin Taylor on the drought in South Iowa. NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about the news to end this week. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll have a criminologist on why some missing persons cases receive more attention than others. Also, what to do about those pesky robocalls. They've been surging in number, at least on my phone, and a good number of people I know, perhaps you as well. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, courts are abuzz with news this week. Let's check the docket with Scott Peters, department head and professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ben.
A few things to rifle through here in a few minutes. On Wednesday, Governor Kim Reynolds promoted a female district judge to the Supreme Court here in Iowa. Fun fact, or perhaps not such a fun fact, Iowa is the only state where all of its current justices on the high court are men. Susan Christensen will be the first woman on Iowa's high court in roughly 8 years. Tell us about her.
Well, she practiced law for about 16 years before becoming a judge. She was an associate district court judge for 4 years and then a district court judge for 7 years. She's from Harlan. And when the governor made her remarks in nominating her, or rather in appointing her yesterday, she specifically mentioned the desire to have someone from a rural part of the state.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention she's a registered Republican, right?
Yes.
And you corrected yourself saying not nominated but appointed, and that's important, too, because our process here in Iowa is different than the federal process, right?
That's correct. We use what's called merit selection, and what happens is that when there's a vacancy, people actually apply for it. A selection commission goes through the applicants, and they pick, they interview them, they look through their applications, and then they forward three names on to the governor, and the governor selects from those names.
Mm-hmm. And this leads to a less politicized court?
Well, I'm not sure I would quite say that. I would say the politics of it tend to look different than they look in other selection systems. So states select and retain their judges in lots of different ways. Some states have partisan elections for judges, for example. And the politics there look quite a bit different. I would say, as we saw in 2010, anytime you're dealing with people exercising political power, you never get politics out of a process. So mm-hmm. the second part of our system here in Iowa is that once the governor appoints the justices, they have to stand for retention elections periodically. They have to. So Justice Christensen will have to stand for an initial retention election in 2020, and then after that, every 8 years.
Mm-hmm. On to a couple of other items. The Iowa Supreme Court, it turns out, will be weighing in on the state's new voter ID law. What would we have this week? A Polk County District Court judge temporarily blocking what in the voter ID law?
Several elements. One of the more significant elements is revolves around the restriction in the amount of time for early voting.
Okay, so this is a shorter window rather than 40 days down to 29 days. So that's okay, math, 11 days.
Right.
Why does 11 days make it so contentious?
Well, the district court ruled that it violates the Iowa Constitution in restricting people's access to the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that these types of choices about opening up access or narrowing access to the ballot affect different populations differently. And typically it's elderly people or poorer people who and also younger people, people like college students, who tend to take a lot of advantage of early access to the ballot, more open hours to vote, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Will this Supreme Court case affect the voting this fall?
It could. I think that's really up to the court in terms of how it handles it. Mm-hmm. It could choose to allow the stay to remain in place, which would mean that the district court's order stays and those elements of the law are not enforced, or it could reverse that stay. It's hard to know at this point.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, let's jump to the federal level, the high court. This week we heard some records sought by U.S. senators about the prior White House service of President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, not available until the end of October. Will this, as you can see, delay the confirmation process?
Again, I'm not sure we know that yet for sure. One of the more interesting things about that is that was just the documents that Senator Grassley, as chair of the Judiciary Committee, has requested.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats want to see even more documents than that, significantly more documents than that. Kavanaugh was a member of the executive branch for a number of years, a lawyer in the executive branch. He participated in the Starr investigation of President Clinton. And so it's a lot of he had his hands on a lot of documents over the years and presumably wrote a lot of memos and gave a lot of legal advice. And so that's what the senators are interested in seeing.
Mm-hmm. Would you put money on, Scott, whether this nominee is approved before our election?
I think it's a very high priority for the Republicans to approve him. I don't know. I haven't heard yet any reaction really from the leadership of the Senate about how they're going to handle this recent announcement from the National Archives that it's going to take longer than expected to compile all these documents and make them available. But it's an extremely high priority for Republicans to try to confirm him before
okay.
the election.
We'll watch the news on that in the weeks to come. Scott Peters, department head and professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's been 2 weeks, 2 weeks of investigators searching for clues, 2 weeks conducting hundreds of interviews in the search for Molly Tibbetts. Molly disappeared on July 18th in Brooklyn, Iowa, a small community about an hour east of Des Moines. Still not clear what happened to the missing 20-year-old University of Iowa student. Yesterday, her family and Crime Stoppers of Central Iowa held a news conference to announce a fund, and so far that fund has raised $172,000 for information. Find out where Molly is. Her unsolved case has received considerable state, national media attention, even international attention. ABC, CNN, Fox News, even the British Broadcasting Corporation, I noticed, had a report on it. Hopefully, Molly will be found soon. Well, this case has reminded us that hundreds of people are listed as missing just in Iowa. Let's talk with a criminologist. Michelle Janisse is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of Louisiana in Lafayette. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. We're contacting you specifically because in 2016, you conducted a study looking at the newsworthiness of missing persons cases. Why do you believe this case has garnered so much attention?
Well, I think previous research and trends that we see in the media suggest that what we have here is an ideal victim. So victims who are typically young, victims who are women, are seen as more ideal, more vulnerable, and those cases are typically newsworthy.
Mm-hmm. So it makes a better story, a riveting story journalistically, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, yes. And we can sort of, it's hard to ascribe guilt or deviance to that type of victim. So we're more likely, it's more likely to pull at our heartstrings. It's more likely to make us feel like she might look like somebody that we know and love. So we're more likely to tune in.
I don't know how much you've been following this case, but I just listed how much media attention around the country, around the world, this missing Iowa woman has been getting. Thoughts specifically on this case?
I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing to have that sort of attention, and hopefully that'll help bring Molly home safe. I would say that this particular type of case, although I, of course, don't know the circumstances any more than the average viewer or reader, it's sort of a similar pattern as to what we've seen in the past when young white co-eds go missing.
What do you mean by that?
Those cases tend to be really newsworthy. They tend to receive out-of-state or national attention compared to perhaps other types of cases or other types of victims.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the outset, hundreds missing in Iowa at any one time on the list of missing persons in Iowa. That must mean thousands, perhaps tens of thousands across the country. Who are most of the missing people? Did you look into that at all in your study?
Well, most people who go missing return home safe, the vast majority of individuals. And within those missing persons cases, anything like a stranger kidnapping is incredibly, profoundly rare. The vast majority of missing persons cases are typically runaway youth.
Yesterday, the mother of Molly Tibbetts said this to the media. I wanted to have your reaction to it. She said, "We believe that Molly is still alive, and if someone has abducted her, we are pleading with you to please release her." This is from Laura Calderwood, the mother. As a criminologist, what does that sort of plea tell you or may tell you about the investigation at this point? Of course, we don't know a lot of the things the investigators do, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't make any assumptions about the case based upon that. It sounds like a loving mother who wants her baby home. It sounds like a commonality we hear with these types of cases.
Mm-hmm. What else did you find out in your 2016 study looking at the newsworthiness of missing persons cases? What conclusions did you make?
So my study suggests the same thing that previous studies suggest, a pattern of bias or disparity in news coverage. So certain types of cases receive more attention, generally speaking, and cases, missing persons cases that involve minority victims, men, or not children, so older individuals, are less likely to receive media attention at local, state, out-of-state, and national level. They're also less likely to receive a contextualized story. So their cases tend to have fewer words associated in print articles or broadcast transcripts.
Michelle, do you have any advice for us, for those interested in this case, helping the investigators find this missing person, Molly, or others?
Absolutely. What we are in the era of is the new milk carton campaign. Our missing persons campaigns have moved to the Internet, and the Internet is thought to be the great equalizer. I've recently conducted a study on a Facebook page dedicated to missing persons cases. This is a forthcoming study. And what we see is that even if you might not have that national media attention, you might not have that social capital, you can create a Facebook page, you can share that image of that missing person and circumstances of that case, and that can increase exposure. Unfortunately, we do see that disparity by age and disparity by race still exists in the social media realm, but perhaps we're getting better, and that is an avenue to increase exposure and decrease disparity.
Okay, thank you very much. Michelle Janisse with the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, professor in the Department of Criminology. Her 2016 study looked at newsworthiness of missing persons cases. Michelle, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In My Town, We Need Immigrants. That's the title of an opinion piece that was published this week in the New York Times. It was penned by Iowan Art Cullen of Storm Lake. Cullen is editor and co-owner of the Storm Lake Times there. He joins us live. Hello, Art.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for joining us. We want to mention here that you won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 2017, and you're the author of a forthcoming book, and we'll have a longer conversation about your book when it comes out, I believe, in October, Storm Lake, A Chronicle of Change, Resilience, and Hope from a Heartland Newspaper. But first of all, to this opinion piece that appeared in the New York Times this week, the article starts off, "Some state Republicans were for building a border wall before Donald Trump gave it a thought, but in many rural areas, immigrants are keeping the place alive." Elaborate on your message as it pertains to Storm Lake.
Well, since 1920, 67, that's two-thirds of Iowa's 99 counties, have lost population every decade. Buena Vista County, where Storm Lake is the county seat, has been reversing that trend in recent decades with an influx of immigrants who work in meatpacking here in a Tyson pork facility and also a Tyson turkey processing facility. And then there's also Rembrandt Foods, which is one of the largest egg processors in North America, which is about 15 miles north of us. And so there's thousands of immigrants working in Storm Lake from Africa, Latin America, and Asia, who all come together here in a fairly peaceful way.
Mm-hmm. Any idea on how many of those thousands, what percentage, are undocumented or illegally in this country?
No, it's anybody's guess. Nobody really knows.
Mm-hmm. What would life be like, the economy, more importantly, be like in Storm Lake? It sounds like it's humming there with those the meat packing and other industries there. Can you imagine without those thousands of workers? Are they taking a job away from other people there?
No, actually, we started during the farm crisis of the 1980s, rural Iowa, Buena Vista County was emptying out like the rest of rural Iowa, and the farm boys who used to come and work in the meatpacking plants had gone to Texas looking for jobs during the farm crisis. And in the meantime, we had Asian refugees, Laotian refugees from the Vietnam War, who came to Storm Lake through Bob Ray's Iowa Shares program. And they took those jobs that Anglos didn't want anymore. And then as meatpacking grew in Storm Lake, as employment grew, there were no Anglos left to take these jobs. And so they searched south of the border in Mexico. And these young single men came in droves mainly from the state of Jalisco.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're having families, and we're showing organic growth here, more births than deaths.
Mm-hmm. A listener I see on my screen wants to know if the undocumented immigrants are being exploited, in his words.
Well, I suppose you could think that a lot of workers are being exploited in many different ways. All I can say is that the production wage at Tyson Storm Lake here for somebody who maybe has a third-grade education or less is about $18 an hour.
Mm.
You start out slightly less than that, and after a probationary period, you make $18 an hour. Maintenance techs, who are a lot of them are Latinos who graduate from Iowa Central Community College here in Storm Lake, are earning over $20 an hour. Now, if that's exploitation, maybe it is. But that they probably make more than most employees of newspapers or public radio stations.
Okay. Storm Lake is in Iowa's 4th district. Your district there voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. For many years has voted for the immigration hardliner, Congressman Steve King. Your message here in the New York Times seems to be really out of step with what most people in the 4th district say is the appropriate policy on immigration. Am I reading that right?
Yes. I guess I would be out of step with the people who voted in the last presidential election. I certainly am out of step with the 4th congressional district. But I'm not out of step with Berkeley Bedell, who represented us in Congress for 12 years as a progressive Democrat. And I'm not out of step with former Senator Tom Harkin, who won Buena Vista County repeatedly. And I don't think I'm out of step with Barack Obama, who won Storm Lake twice.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Donald Trump's recent visit to Piasta near Dubuque? He spoke about immigration policy there, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's actually what generated the essay for the New York Times. Was Trump was there for a job trainings roundtable, and he just couldn't help himself. He had to launch into another tirade on immigration. And it started me to thinking about Julio Barroso, who was an 8-year-old boy in 1996 who got deported from Storm Lake. And my son Tom, who's a reporter here at the newspaper, has spent the last 2 years trying to find him. And he found him on Wednesday, the day before Trump came to Iowa. And Julio was the only thing on my mind, not Donald Trump and not Rod Blum and not Kim Reynolds. It was Julio. Whatever happened to Julio? And you know what? Now he's slaughtering chickens for 85 hours a week for one-tenth the money he could earn here 40 hours a week if he could only slaughter turkeys here. And we need Julio, but Julio can't get back.
Hmm. What are the thoughts in Storm Lake, as far as you can tell, being the co-owner and editor of the Storm Lake Times, about the $12 billion package for farmers that the president announced last week?
I think everybody views it as a relief, but as one farmer and local auctioneer, Kevin Cohn, said, it just drives him crazy because we're shooting ourselves in the foot. It's an unforced error. We didn't need to do this. And so soybeans got knocked down $2, and then they come back 30 cents last week, and then Trump makes some more stupid comments about China, and then they shave that week's 30-cent gain off in one day.
The president says he's playing a longer game, that you have to have patience.
Well, I hope that 30% of young farmers in Iowa can afford to play that long game past next spring, because they're about ready to go broke. That's what Iowa State University will tell you, and that's what most bankers will tell you. They're on edge.
Mm. Let's say the president would visit Storm Lake, as he did to Piasta. You're the tour guide. What would you want him to see, to do, to experience in Storm Lake?
Well, first, I'd want him to eat something other than a cheeseburger and a Coke, and maybe visit La Juanita's restaurant, where a Latino has made a living and has bought a farm by selling $4 burritos. I'd like him to meet the owner of La Juanita's, and I would like him to meet the owner of Morello's Mexican Meat Market in Storm Lake, his wife works one shift, he works a second shift, and while the other one's working at the pack, the other one's minding the meat business. I'd like him to meet those people.
Mm. What's the solution for the terrible divide in our country over immigration policy? We've just a few seconds left. Art?
Well, if we call ourselves Christian people, which a lot of Trump voters like to do, then we ought to pay attention to the least among us.
Okay. Art Cullen, co-owner and editor of the Storm Lake Times. He penned a piece that appears, an essay in the New York Times this week, titled "In My Town, We Need Immigrants." He won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 2017, author of a forthcoming book, and we're going to have Art back on sometime in October, I hope, to talk about it. Storm Lake, A Chronicle of Change, Resilience, and Hope from a Heartland Newspaper. Art, thank you very much for your time.
And come on up to Storm Lake. The boating's good.
All right. Thanks, Art.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about those pesky robocalls, why they are surging, and what you can do about it. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. So good you could be with us on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about the news to end the week. Plenty to come this half hour. Later on, Katie Pikus will be with it. Our new IPR's new Western Iowa reporter, Elwin Taylor, climatologist, talking about the drought in South Iowa. But let's talk with Lynn Hicks, first of all. How many pesky robocalls do you get in a week? I get a couple per day, buzzing my phone while I'm researching for this show or in the studio. If you're in the same boat, it's not just annoying for you and for me. They are getting worse for most of us. Joining us now, Lynn Hicks is Communications Director for the Iowa Attorney General. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm fine. Who is doing this to us? What evil overlord?
That's right. Well, they're coming from all over. And unfortunately, a lot of them are coming from overseas, which limits our ability and limits our national officials' ability to crack down on this. Mm-hmm. But yes, they are. That's what Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller calls these the bane of our existence. So we're all frustrated about it.
They can range from, well, at best, they're just disturbances, annoying disturbances, maybe about a mortgage, refinancing your mortgage or whatever. But they can be that can be the guise for a scam. They could be costly financial scams. I want to play a couple examples, Lynn, to have your reaction to that, get your advice. This is an IRS scam that many of our listeners will recognize. Have you got a call like this before?
To inform you that IRS is filing lawsuit against you. To get more information about this case file, please call immediately on our department number 202-470-2565. I repeat, 202-470-2565. Thank you.
Okay, you're supposed to hang up. Don't do what they said. But here's a clip from a YouTube vlogger, V. Westlife, who actually called back that number that the scammer gave in the voice message. And here's what he heard when he called that number.
Thank you for calling Internal Revenue Service, Criminal Investigation Division. All officers are busy right now. Please leave us your name, last four of your social, and the best contact number to reach you. And the consent officer of your case will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you.
Yeah, that sure didn't sound like the IRS to me. I noticed they asked for part of your social security number. Can you say identity theft?
Yes, we can. V. Westlife, the vlogger there, Lynn Hicks. So they're fishing for information, right? If you would call back and give that information, what would happen?
Yes, yes. Do not call back. And unfortunately, we continue to get a lot of complaints about the IRS scam. You'll notice the 202. So it seems legitimate. You may be getting a call that is spoofed. The number is spoofed, so it it appears to be coming from Washington D.C. So. First of all, don't call back. When you get a call like this, the IRS is not going to call you, first of all, like this. Second of all, hang up as immediately as possible. Do not answer any questions. Do not give out any Social Security numbers. Don't even, sometimes you'll get a call that says to prevent getting any more calls, press 2 or something like that. Don't press 2 because that tells the robocaller that you're a legitimate target. So, just hang up.
Right, right. Anything you do, they're like, it really is just like fishing out there. They've got their line in the water. They got thousands, millions of lines out there. And if you press a number, say something, they know they got some, you've reacted to the bait.
That's correct.
What is being done about this at a federal level, at a state level, at your attorney general's office level, by Congress?
That's right. Well, this is the top consumer complaint for many law enforcement, for the FCC, for us, and FCC is they've started cracking down and doing millions of dollars in enforcement actions. They recently had a $120 million fine against a man in Florida. They've changed some rules. We were part of a group of attorney generals who wrote them and said advocated changing some of the rules to allow phone companies to block certain types of these calls so they don't reach consumers. The FCC agreed on that. We've another thing that the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, is doing is it's empowering companies to come up with blocking technology. Mm-hmm. There's a website out there that I would point to. It's called nomorobo.com, nomorobo.com. And that is essentially an app that you can have on your cell phone that will screen. It has different settings, but it can screen or block some of these calls. And it's all an attempt to kind of stay one step ahead of the scammers, but that's really hard. So that's some of the things that the FCC is and the FTC is doing.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, before we go, tell us quickly about one
unfortunate incident involving the an auto shop in Indianola that became a target of robocallers.
Right. We got a call about this. This was a what happens is what I talked about spoofing is that some of these scammers will go and they will actually take somebody's phone number and then use that to make their robocalls and scam calls. And so, unfortunately, there was a auto shop in Indianola that had been used. And so then, you know, a robocaller was calling people and saying, offering an extended warranty and student loan debt information, things like that. And as a result, everybody called back this number. So this business had more than $2,500 calls in a few days from customers saying, why are you calling me? Why are you calling me? So it was a disruption in business for them. Unfortunately, you know, a place like this shop can't simply not answer the phone if they don't recognize a number. You know, what we tell businesses, if this happens, you can always put a voicemail out there saying, we've been the victim of a phone scam, of spoofing. If you receive a call from this number, you know, it's not us. Fortunately, it usually doesn't last long because these scammers will go on to the next number. They'll pick another target. So it doesn't last long, but it is a huge disruption for a business like this.
Okay, Lynn Hicks, thank you for bringing us up to date on the robocalls, spoofing, as you said. Communications Director for the Iowa Attorney General, Lynn Hicks. Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Perhaps you've noticed we have a new reporter in the field. We're so happy about it. We have filled a long sought after and a newly created position in the person of Katie Pikus, our IPR Western Iowa reporter. Katie Pikus, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to hear your reporting. We thought it was a chance for listeners now to get to know you a little bit. And we should say we're thankful to Siouxland Public Media, KWIT, on the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College. That's where you're based. That's where you will be based as we hear your reporting. Introduce yourself, Katie. Tell us where you come to us from.
Well, I come to Iowa from Delaware. I was previously a science reporter at the NPR affiliate in Delaware. And before Delaware, I was in Utah for a year as a newspaper reporter, but I'm originally from Connecticut.
Excellent. So tell us about some of the stories you've been covering in your first couple of weeks.
All right. Well, kind of the first few things I've started on, there is this regional expo center project in Sioux City that's a partnership between Sioux City and Woodbury County. And officials are kind of boasting that this $11 to $12 million expo center project for farm shows and sporting events could be an economic driver for the region. But kind of a little bit of a hurdle in all of that is that there have been a lot of changes to this project over the years. It's gone from this primarily agricultural expo center project to now more of a general focus with, you know, agriculture, sporting mm-hmm. events, all that kind of stuff. The cost has gone down over the years, and now county officials are saying, you know, we'd like to think about our contribution to this project. So they're kind of talking about possibly decreasing the amount that they would commit to the project, which was originally going to be $1.5 million over 10 years. So they're not sure yet, and that's kind of where I've left the story off for now. We'll probably hear more about that mm-hmm. soon, especially because construction on this expo center is slated to start in summer 2019.
You've also been reporting on the beautification of a project there near the Iowa Great Lakes, right?
I have. It seems like people here really, really cherish the Iowa Great Lakes, and I have not been there yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing them soon.
All right. On the sad side for the environment, there was an oil spill you covered.
There was, and that happened before I got here, but I kind of picked up where things left off in terms of the cleanup on that. You know, there was a lot of flooding in June in northwest Iowa, and this crude oil train derailed in Lyon County and leaked crude oil into the Rock River. As far as cleanup goes, a lot of the topsoil had to be removed, and anything that's kind of being removed right now is being taken to a landfill in Dickinson County, which is in the Iowa Great Lakes region. So officials have told me that their primary concern is ignorance and not knowing what's in the material going to the landfill. And they've been communicating with the crude oil, the railway company. They've been talking with the Iowa DNR, and they've been learning more about that in terms of, you know, what is the material that's going to the landfill from the spill cleanup? Is it safe? And there is this fear because they live in this big tourism region near beautiful lakes. But right now, it's just a lot of communication going back and forth between the county and the BNSF Railway Company and the company that owns the landfill as well.
Katie Pikus, it's so nice to have someone on site finally for Iowa Public Radio there in western Iowa. We should probably outline the vision. You know, this is all, of course, made possible, goes without saying, by support of Iowa Public Radio listeners. We don't get to expand, make our coverage better, our news coverage better, without the strong support of the best ever public radio supporters in the world, those in Iowa. So the vision for this Western Iowa reporter, Katie, is what, as you understand it?
As I understand it, it's to bring a different perspective to our coverage in Iowa. You know, we've got people in Des Moines, we've got people in eastern Iowa, and in western Iowa, which tends to veer more Republican, we didn't have anyone before I got here. So
right.
It's interesting to get that perspective and bring it to the reporting.
Right. From Delaware to Utah to Iowa, now that you've been here a few weeks, what excites you most about your beat as the Western Iowa reporter?
Pretty much everything. You know, I just love going to a new community and really just getting to learn more about new people, a new place. I really like the Lost Hills region, so I'm learning a lot about that, and it's really pretty out here. So.
Yeah, right. Is there anything about Iowa that you landed here, have soaked it up for a few weeks, and said, wow, that surprises me?
I will say it surprises me every time I think about the fact that the state has 99 counties coming here from Delaware, which had 3. I'm still trying to learn the names of all the counties around here.
Yes, you will be expected to answer that on a quiz in a short amount of time. All right, Katie Pikus, we look forward to all the great reporting we know is coming to us from you as our brand new, first ever IPR Western Iowa reporter. Katie, welcome to the state and welcome to IPR.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has ordered a disaster declaration for Davis County. That's in southern South Iowa. The adjacent counties of Appanoose, Jefferson, Monroe, Van Buren, and also Wapello will also be able to receive assistance. The reason? Southern Iowa has seen extensive damage to crops and livestock from the recent drought. Here to tell us more about it, Elwin Taylor, professor of ag meteorology, extension climatologist at ISU. Elwin, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's good to be with you, and I'm sorry that it's because of a problem that we're having in the state.
Right. It seems that happens when we get in contact, you are the reason is. What's been going on in southern Iowa? This is sort of, if you look on a map, it sort of reaches down into Missouri, right, and up into the most southern counties in Iowa.
It does indeed, south central especially, and parts of Missouri. We divide the states into crop reporting districts. They're also climate reporting districts. They're identical. The districts were set up back when the USDA owned the National Weather Service. And so the climate districts and the, as well as the crop districts are identical. And when we come in to a county level, and that county has had a reduction to 10% below normal for feed for cattle or production of a crop, then that's considered a disaster.
Mm.
And because, well, by technically the crop has been decimated. Decimated means cut by 10% below normal, and that is considered an emergency. And then that county and all counties that are immediately adjacent to it come under the disaster relief.
So,
because, of course, drought does not know anything about county lines.
Right. Elwin, so what are farmers in this area faced with at this point in the season?
Well, the thing that we have is, if you've got a lack of feed and you've got animals out there that are grazing, then you've got an immediate problem. If you've got lack of yields or something that when you're harvested, like corn or soybean, you've got a problem that's waiting to add up when your harvest is much below what you need either for your animals or for your finances because you sell that produce. Well, we have been comparing what's going on this year with what went on last year, and we are finding that, for the most part, we have an aridity problem, not as bad as it could be. When the precipitation is low, we know that things will maybe be arid. Also, it can be hot, and if it's hotter than usual, that has the same effect as being drier than usual. If it's hotter and drier, then we have a real problem. If the temperatures aren't as hot as normal, then plants need less water. In fact, every 10 degrees hotter doubles the amount of water that the plants need per day or per week or however you want to look at it. So if we should be normally 80 degrees each day and it's going up to 90, we just plants are needing twice as much water if they're not getting it. We've got a drought because of the heat or because of the lack of precipitation. Either one, they combine just because it's the demand as well as the amount of rain that actually falls.
Okay, Elwin, I'm sure our listeners would appreciate in the 30 seconds we have left a outlook for the state weather-wise. What are you seeing?
The hope is the El Nino is developing. The fear is that it doesn't get here until the crop is all finished, that El Nino keeps us closer to normal, both temperature and precipitation. And that should make a pleasant winter. It would have been nice to have had it in place a month or two ago to make a pleasant growing season.
Indeed. Elwin, thank you so much. A professor of ag meteorology and extension climatologist at Iowa State University. Always nice to chat with you, Elwin. We'll look for a good weather report to have you on next time.
I hope you'll try to find that.
All right. Elwin Taylor, always nice to have Elwin on. Well, we're finishing up the program. Let's groove into the weekend with some music from the Hinterland Festival, which is happening on the weekend. Here to tell us a little bit about it, Tony Daner. He is a production assistant and IPR Studio One host. Hi, Tony.
Hey there, Ben.
Quickly, we have a few minutes here. Some great headliners at the Hinterland Music Festival. St. Charles, Iowa is the place. If you don't know where that is, well, that's the idea behind the festival, right?
Yeah, little bit south of Des Moines in Madison County at the amphitheater. It's a beautiful outdoor festival, camping. Looks to be nice weather this weekend, so it's going to be a lot of fun. Can't wait for it.
Got some music from some headliners. Who are we going to hear?
Yeah, tonight the headliner is Band of Horses from South Carolina, and this is a great band, kind of a little bit of a country Americana influence, but also definitely some indie rock in there. We're going to hear a song from an album they put out a few years ago called Why Are You Okay? This song is called Throw My Mess, Band of Horses.
Band of Horses, they'll be playing Friday at 9:30 in the evening at the Hinterland Festival. Time for one more, Tony.
Yeah,
who's the other headliner here?
The Saturday night headliner, Sturgill Simpson. I kind of think of him as a reluctant country superstar. He's kind of both his music and kind of his public appearances, he's somebody who kind of thumbs his nose at the country music establishment. Meanwhile, his 2016 album, A Sailor's Guide to Earth, was nominated for a Grammy for Best Country Album and Album of the Year. So he's somebody who kind of snuck in, and a great country singer-songwriter. And this song we're going to hear is from that album. It's called Sea Stories.
Okay, let's go out with Sturgill Simpson playing Saturday at Hinterland Festival as a headliner. Let's hear a Sturgill with this number.
Basic, but just like a papa said, keep your mouth shut and you'll be fine. Just another enlisted in the bowl for Uncle Sam's beating. But when you get to damn neck.
Hopefully that gave you taste enough to head to St. Charles, Iowa, Hinterland Music Festival, August 3rd and 4th. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.